I would love for the psychoanalytic world to re-embrace some of these adjunctive treatments that get to non-ordinary states of consciousness in order to enhance psychoanalytic treatment. And that includes psychedelics. The other thing I'd like to see is I think psychoanalysts are extremely well suited to use psychedelic-assisted therapy in a non-harmful way. I really believe that without an ongoing treatment relationship, that these medicines are not going to be quick fixes. There's an article in the Substack blog, Ecstatic Integration, about a man, an Israeli man, who had an MDMA treatment for chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a very interesting read, and it really does speak to the crucial aspect of having an ongoing therapy relationship while you're using these medicines. So I want people who are in the analytic field, who are trained right out of the box to provide these containers, to be more involved in the psychedelic field. And for the psychedelic field, I think sometimes I wish they would be a little more humble, a little less zealous about the efficacy, and a little more concerned about what could happen that's harmful. And I also think the psychedelic field, for some reason, has not embraced, well, I think I know the reason, but not embraced psychoanalysis as a major tool to enhance the medicine.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Charis Claudius. Dr. Claudius is a child and adult psychoanalyst who trained at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. She has been practicing psychoanalysis for a very long time, and she shares with us today how she has reoriented her clinical approach to patient care. She has come to include adjunctive treatments in ongoing depth psychotherapies. And the particular adjunct we talk about today is the use of ketamine to what she feels is enable the patients to more deeply and more quickly engage their core conflicts in a way that's useful and productive for the work. We begin with two things. We begin with her reading a quote from Maimonides that she feels was an inspiration for her to help her always be looking for new ways to be attentive to her patients' needs. And we also begin with a caution. We know that when we change the analytic frame, one must be extra careful to be attentive to countertransference factors that may be influencing that. And my pleasure in having this conversation with her is that she's very sober about this approach. She is not overly enthusiastic about it. She doesn't feel it is the cure-all for everything, as some talk about it in that spirit. She is a seasoned clinician, and in that spirit is careful, but not careful to the point of avoiding new approaches. And I think there's something in that spirit that is useful for all of us to keep in mind. As I say, she trained at the Boston Psychoanalytic Institute, where she is now on the faculty. She's also on the faculty at Tufts University School of Medicine. She is the course director of an experiential elective for first-year medical students at Tufts called The Healer's Art, Rekindling the Heart and Soul of Medicine. And she established a pilot retreat program, First Aid for Physicians, through Tufts Medical Center. She is trained in EMDR and deep brain reorienting and has completed the first phase of MDMA training through MAPS, which is a certifying body, a training and certifying body for psychedelic students of psychedelic medicine, and has a certificate in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy from the Fluence Center for Psychedelic Training in New York. She is a member of the International Society for the Treatment of Trauma and Dissociation's Special Interest Group on Psychoanalytic Contributions to the Treatment of Trauma and Dissociation. I found our conversation to be inspiring on the one hand, certainly, challenging. It challenges the way we think about our work. It challenges what we might be too settled in our approaches. And she really stimulates us to say, well, is this the best we can be doing for patients? And wherever we land on that question, it's always good to be asking it. And she, I think, is somebody who can help us engage that challenge. I hope you enjoy this as I have. Charis, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you.
Delighted to be here.
There has been a great deal of attention given to the role of psychedelic medicines, both in the media and in the scientific literature. And most of the attention has been devoted to the often profound studies, many of them double-blind control studies, that document the usefulness of these medicines to make radical changes in patients who have had disabling symptoms for sometimes decades. It's been well documented to be useful in unremitting depression or disabling post-traumatic conditions. It's also being studied with some promising results for addictions and obsessive-compulsive disorder, eating disorders, and individuals facing terminal illnesses. It's really a revolution in how we understand the treatment of psychiatric symptoms. Less well known, but important to many of us, is the ongoing work that's being done that shows it is useful, these psychedelic medicines, and we're going to talk about which ones and how and all, as an adjunct to depth psychotherapy. Now, we've been down this road before, in a sense, in that we have learned to introduce psychiatric medicines of a more familiar sort as adjuncts to dynamic psychotherapy. And for many individuals, their therapies wouldn't be possible were it not in conjunction with psychiatric medicines. And there is great interest in this area of psychedelic medicines as adjunct. The health committee of the IPA, the International Psychoanalytic Association, recently held a webinar on the topic of the interface between psychedelic medicines and psychoanalysis. And I was pleased to be the moderator of this webinar. And we had four guests who are leading researchers and clinicians in this field. And we had participants from over 40 countries. So there's something very important for us to learn about. And I think it's also important that we begin our conversation with a caution. You and I both know that it takes many years of clinical work to learn how to co-create a psychoanalytic frame that's attuned to each individual's capabilities. This frame is both delicate and powerful and is a vital part of our ability to heal. Given that, before an analyst or any clinician instigates a change in the frame, and certainly introducing mind-altering medicine is a change in the frame, before one does that, one has to be quite cautious about being attentive to the countertransference forces that may be active inside one. That said, one should not use that caution to rationalize an inhibition. And it is also true that we need to honor the creativity that we have available to us today to introduce changes in the frame to reach patients who are otherwise unreachable. And instead of just saying, you know, we've reached bedrock or the person isn't treatable, that your work, which we're going to spend time on today, has really, and others, of course, has challenged us to think creatively and not just write people off as saying, well, they can't be reached. And you have a wonderful origin story that I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners about your search for ways to reach people who aren't ordinarily being reached. You have a great sentence you wrote me in an email, and you said, "What I find so interesting about this work is that I keep looking for ways to access what is inaccessible in our model." And you've expanded a patient's accessibility. And we're going to start off with your origin story and your quote, and then we're going to talk clinical cases today, because that's the best way to help people understand both the cautions about this work, the risks about this work, and some of the important breakthroughs that this work can offer individuals. With that as an introduction, the floor is yours. Why don't you tell us your story?
Okay. So before I tell the story, I just want to say one thing about our history as analysts. And I'd like to honor the analysts in the 60s who actually understood the concept of inaccessibility and limitations in the treatment and used, for example, LSD during sessions to help with accessibility. And there are some beautiful examples of that. So we do have a history of using our pretty exquisite training to be a container for these medicines.
Let me add to that point. Sitting right next to me is a book. It's called Psychedelic Drugs. It's an edited volume in 1969. That represents a meeting that took place where I'm located in Philadelphia. And it was edited by analysts, many of whom were my teachers. Mm. And of course, as we know, the research was shut down after the 60s. But This is new work and it's old work. We are really picking up from where some of the pioneers were interested in going back then and exploring it. So let me second your emphasis on that. It's an important point.
Right. It's beautiful to read some of their case histories. My sort of origin story in terms of how I got interested in this particular field is basically a story where I got very angry with my husband. So my husband took a new job, and I thought the old job was all done. And then my husband announced that he was going to go off to the old job. He needed to go to a medical school graduation at UMass. So he had to do this, of course, on a weekend day. And I had kids, and I thought, oh my God, not this again. So I was pretty furious. And he came back, graduation was over, came back, dumped his stuff on the kitchen counter. And one of the things he dumped on the kitchen counter was the program. So I took a look at the program, and what do I see but the oath that the medical students at graduation were taking? And the oath, so I sat and read the oath, and I'm going to read it now. It's the oath of Maimonides. And this essentially changed my trajectory. So I'll read it now. The eternal providence has appointed me to watch over the life and health of my fellow human beings. May the love for my art actuate me at all times. May neither avarice nor miserliness nor thirst for glory or for great reputation engage my mind. For the enemies of truth and philanthropy could easily deceive me and make me forgetful of my aim of doing good to my patients. May I never see in the patient anything but a fellow creature in pain. Grant me strength, time, and opportunity always to correct what I have acquired, always to extend its domain, for knowledge is immense, and the spirit of humanity can extend itself infinitely to enrich itself daily with new requirements. Today, we can discover our errors of yesterday, and tomorrow, we may obtain a new light on what we think ourselves sure of today. I've been appointed to watch over the life and death of my fellow human beings. Here I am, ready for my vocation, and now I turn unto my calling.
That's quite a paragraph. I had never heard that till you shared it with me, and it's something we should all have in our offices.
Yes. So I sat down on the floor of the kitchen and just started crying. Yeah. It was so beautiful and moving. And yeah. I think what I realized inside is that perhaps I hadn't been as vigilant as I should be in trying to find other ways of helping my patients. And so I went off on a journey of sorts, doing other kinds of trainings. One of them was EMDR, which was absolutely fascinating. I read a ton about trauma, including sort of ego state theory, read a lot about dissociative identity disorder. Then I trained in deep brain reorienting, which is another technique. And all these trainings are very interesting because they're in big groups and you break out into little groups and do the procedures on each other with one person watching. So it was really been an incredible education. And then I was gravitated toward psychedelics and ketamine, I think because they're medicines. And as a doctor, I feel very comfortable giving medicines. Mm-hmm. I do it all the time. And the idea that I could use a medicine to really enhance my psychoanalytic treatments was very, that idea was very compelling to me. So what I did is I went to two trainings, one which was terrible and bothered me a lot. And then I found another one, which was a very rigorous, almost year-long training in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, where actually there were electives you could do. And one of the electives, when I looked at the list, was psychoanalytic explorations of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Mm. I don't know how to describe it. I was urgently wanting to take that course and very surprised that two analysts were teaching it. So I signed up for the course and I remember, you know, logging onto Zoom, seeing, you know, 12 bright, eager faces from all over the world. And then two of really the most lovely, smart, creative, integrative analysts I've had the pleasure of meeting.
How fortunate.
So it was wonderful.
Well, that's a great introduction. And let's talk about what it's like to be working with a patient and to decide that you want to add this kind of medication, because that's the pivot moment. There's the skill in how to use it for sure, but there's also the decision to use it. And let us into your mind about what goes on about that.
Well, so I think that we all have internal processes where sooner or later, I think maybe especially as physicians, sooner or later, the intuitive sense pops into your mind. Do I think this patient needs an SSRI? Do I think this patient needs a mood stabilizer? There's an intuitive sense. And I think you have to develop your intuitive sense when you learn about a new medicine. And I'm really a beginner, and the whole field is, you know, in its beginning.
Sure.
But I would say that when I see my patients going over and over the same thing, and I think in the trauma world, one calls it looping, you know, and looping refers to something about one's character structure that just doesn't allow one to move further. And we could get into the default mode network, all that business. But I think when I see my patients unable to go deeper into the treatment, that is when I think about ketamine. Now, that's an interesting idea because it's a little like it's ketamine is the last resort, for example. Mm-hmm. Very similar to the way it's prescribed for treatment-resistant depression. You know, everybody's right. Tried everything, and now we're going to move to ketamine. But I would say that is when I see the looping and I see people not being able to go deeper, that I think about using it.
Now, if one was in an analytic conference and you presented a case who was looping, ruminative, using narcissistic defenses, different languages describing the same thing, there would be a whole array of ideas and suggestions about what might be contributing to this impasse. And of course, countertransference factors would be front and center. And we've all had the experience where patients are stuck and we realize that we're stuck with the patient. There's something happening in us that's stuck. And if through consultation or self-analysis or ongoing analysis, as the case may be, that it can open something up in ourselves and in the treatment. And what you're describing, I don't want to speak for you, I'm assuming that you have been through all those checklist of questions that you might have before you would add a medicine. And I don't want to speak for you for that, but share with us your mental process about that.
So I totally agree with you about that. One, I think one has a checklist, but one also has almost an implicit trial of saying this or moving it that way,
right,
or, you know, technical trials. And so I think that for me, it's more of an intuitive technical trial. I might do various things with the patient to try to move them deeper. You know, in fact, transference has a huge place in that. And so, you know, trying to open the relational field a little bit more in right. a relaxed way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I use countertransference less often than I use interpersonal attempts to move things.
We may be saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's after those efforts to bring the patient alive in the transference, counter-transference matrix, that when that doesn't work, that's when you find yourself thinking, perhaps a medicine would help him or her.
Right. And I also want to say something about this. It's one thing, the medicine is a really exciting thing for me to be using, but there are other ways to do it, including, for example, the couch. So this patient, these are all non-ordinary states of consciousness. And one thing we do that maybe sometimes I've actually forgotten about is the couch is a way of enhancing a non-ordinary state of consciousness.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've lost other techniques. Like we've really lost hypnosis. We had it, but we don't use it anymore. But that's a non-ordinary state of consciousness. EMDR is, deep brain reorienting is, and psychedelics are. And so with the patient I'm going to talk about, you know, he came in, he was in crisis. And so he sat up for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
But his level of vigilance and anxiety was so intense that I actually suggested that he use the couch, which is somewhat unusual for me. I mean, I'm a child analyst and I do, you know, do a lot of work with kids. So, you know, but he used the couch. He started to use the couch
right.
And did relax.
Uh-huh.
It enhanced associative work.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And yet
he would come in. Long silences. Dr. C, I don't have much for you today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have much. And then there would be sort of the looping behavior. So.
Okay. All right. That's the clinical challenge you were facing, and you made the decision to go the medicine route and walk us through that.
Okay. So should I talk to you a little bit about the patient first, do you think?
Just, yeah, to set up what happened, what led you to make the decision, which you just began doing, and then what the procedure was that shifted. I mean, I assume patients come to you, and maybe because of your reputation in this area, they know to be open to medicines, or maybe he didn't know that, and he was just coming to you for care, and of a more routine sort. And how did you introduce it to him and what happened?
So this is very interesting. It's exactly like a beginner in analytic training. So I was training to be a ketamine-assisted psychotherapist
right.
while
okay.
I was seeing him. And so I had the absolutely, you know, typical worries about using the medicine. It would be my first time that I was going to, you know, use a medicine with a patient. So I knew that I felt like this was going to take a little while for him and that we were kind of up against it. And I was listening to his looping and I let him know that I was training in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy and that I thought it might help him access feelings. Because one thing he really wanted was to be able to access more of his feeling states, that he's anxious, that he's, you know, a very kind of hail fellow well met.
Mm-hmm.
He is trying to please everybody all the time. He came in a crisis and he had a hard time with things like grief, sadness, tenderness. And so I told him I thought that the medicine might help with that. And that might enhance the way that our psychotherapy went.
Now, it's an interesting moment because just to share my reaction to what you're saying, a patient like this who comes in and says, I really want to get access to my inner life, and I have a sense that I don't have as much as would benefit me and the people around me. When I would hear that manifest chief complaint, I would also realize that there's a big task ahead of us, because he's entirely unaware of the part of himself that doesn't want that very thing he claimed to want, and that what's blocking it are unconscious forces that are within him that says there's some kind of danger, presumably
exactly.
from a childhood distortion. There's a danger exactly. that says, I can't go there.
Exactly. So we used to talk about that.
Right.
And I actually used his defenses to describe what would happen in ketamine. So our way of talking about his defenses were, my way of talking about it was to describe that he has these protective, almost managing defenses. And he would immediately, and very playfully, because he's a very playful guy, call them his managers, his little managers.
Okay.
And, you know, he was in a business field. And so that's a term that I think he felt sure. very comfortable with. So he would say, you know, my little managers prevent me from moving, you know, and if I were to say something to him that was a little scary, he said, my managers are coming in.
Okay. So you introduce the ketamine to him, and how do you do it? What kind of dose? What kind of IM, IV, oral? How do you administer it?
So I can do it because I'm a physician. I can do it intramuscularly.
Right.
But I first started to do it orally. And so, you know, it's a sublingual pill. You put it under your tongue. It takes about 15 minutes for the medicine to be absorbed. And the medicine is absorbed through the skin, inside your mouth.
And what dose do you start with?
So I start with this, and this is the other thing. I think one can safely administer this medicine. And this is something that the training really emphasized, where I did the very rigorous training, low and slow.
Okay,
that's the motto.
Yeah.
So
right.
low and slow would be about 100 milligrams, a 100 milligram tablet.
Okay.
And it varies from individual to individual. So 100 milligrams for one patient might not produce any change. And for another patient, it might give them a very powerful response.
All right. Now, is this for a regular, let's say, 45-minute session, or describe for us the practical frame that you're in?
So the practical frame is such that the office is prepared. The ketamine tends to last for about an hour, a little over. And then there's sort of a recovery phase where the patient is very open to discussion in a way they might not be open mm-hmm. in the normal psychotherapy with you. So I would say the entire process takes about 2.5 to 3 hours. For me, that's longer than many people give the process, but I like to keep my patients for a while after the medicine wears off, because I find that's a time when we can do some really good intimate work. But the office has changed. So the office, you know, if this were on Zoom, I would have pictures of it, but, you know, I put a white sheet and blanket on the couch. There are candles. The office is darkened.
Is there music?
Music. There's music.
Of your choosing or the patient's choosing? Because I've heard both.
Most patients want me to choose the music, but I'm actually terrible with the music. There are a bunch of playlists that you can get on Spotify, which I've been using. I asked this patient what kind of music he likes. And I gave him some choices around, do you like, you know, jazz? Do you like new age? Do you like, he said, I want sort of rainforesty type music. Mm-hmm. So that's what I chose.
Okay. Now, is he speaking with you while he's under the influence of the medicine? Or is it varied
yes.
by, he is speaking?
Yes. He is speaking.
About the stuff of psychotherapy that he had been speaking before?
It's very, very, he opens up in a way that's really very remarkable. So one thing that's very important to tell one's patients is that, you know, among many other things, but I think this is very key, is that when the medicine starts to work, your normal defenses, in this case with him, I said, you know, your manager guys are gonna go away. And they're gonna start to go away. And when that happens for patients, sometimes it feels fine, but sometimes it's very scary. And at that point, I introduce the idea of touch, because sometimes it's so scary that people want to hold a hand or to have a shoulder, have you put your hand on their shoulder. And so I think that's the time usually that people need something a little bit more. That's to talk to you a little bit about the process of letting go and surrendering to lack of defenses. And so his process, once that happened, was without his protector people.
Now, let me ask you, you've just said a bunch that we should spend a moment on. Anytime you bring up the word touch, I think all kinds of reactions are elicited in the listener, mm-hmm. because that's a potentially dangerous area.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
Tell me your experience with it. I mean, we know it can be dangerous. That is, by dangerous, I mean it can be seductive, suggested. It can lead to more touching that isn't in the patient's best interest,
and it can feel assaultive.
Better said, yes, right, right. So how do you parse that, and what have you learned from doing it?
How do I parse it? So first of all, let me say that I'm actually pretty comfortable with touch being a physician. So I think that mm-hmm. we could talk a lot about what we give up as physicians when we go into psychiatry and we go into psychoanalysis and we learn to, I think, become a little bit afraid of it. So for me, there was some kind of return to physicianhood when I realized or was trained that touch might be necessary. That's what it, I think, brought up for me. It did not bring up fear. And it brought up, actually, I was pretty confident that I wouldn't run into difficulty. But the literature is replete with descriptions of how one can run into difficulty, especially because the patient is much more vulnerable, has much less autonomy than they have in a typical psychoanalytic or psychotherapeutic session. And you, as the clinician, feel much closer to the patient, which is very interesting. The medicine experience affects you as the clinician, even though you're not taking the medicine.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
And so you feel so much closer that I can imagine, although haven't experienced this, that if there's, for example, an erotic transference, it could be really tough.
Tough, meaning tough as in vulnerable, precarious, dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had that experience, but I can imagine thinking about boundary violations in our field, for example. I can imagine that tendency would be enhanced in a dyad during psychedelic.
Now, when you said our field, I didn't know which field you were referring to, the analytic field or the psychedelic field or both.
Well, I was thinking, when I said it, I was thinking about the analytic field, but it absolutely applies to the psychedelic field as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this patient was under the influence, and he was talking to you while under the influence of the medicine about the therapy things that he had been talking to you about prior, but he was doing it in a more open way. And by open, you mean more affectively alive and related and emotional? Is that what you mean by that?
You know, he would say things like 15 minutes after he put the medicine under his tongue, he said, I'm feeling time slowing. I feel like I'm in my own little cocoon. Things are expanding and contracting. Uh-oh, the protector guy is confused. He doesn't know what to protect. It seems like there's nothing to protect. So that was, you know, for me, this was my first patient. So for me, this was an unbelievable thing to hear. And then he said, I've never had this feeling before. And then he said, giving up control to the drug is scary, Dr. C. And I said, I'm right here. And that's the other thing to say is that when the patient is on the couch with eye mask on, I'm sitting right next to the couch. So I say, because I'm right next to the couch, I say, I'm right here. And he just grabs my hand. So that was a moment where, you know, it was absolutely the way the training described what might happen and when touch might be required. So I held his hand for a while, and, you know, he kept holding it. And then there's the issue of, when does he not need my hand anymore? And what would it be like for me to pull my hand away? So, of course, one has to wonder what the meaning of it is for the patient in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're very good at thinking about that in our field, which right. makes us really good providers for this kind of medicine, in my opinion. So I think to myself, and I say to him finally, would you like your hand back? And he said, yes, please. And then mm-hmm. I put my hand.
And when the medicine wears off and he's with you for time afterwards, and you say you continue your conversation, how is that conversation different from when he's under the influence?
So it's a spectrum, sort of, it's on a continuum.
Uh-huh.
So he might have an initial rush from the medicine. And I think you can hear that in the teeny little bit of process I
right.
just read. But also he might say, I just want to say a little bit of what it's like during the medicine. He will say things like, I feel pulled away from something and pushed towards something at the same time. Now, this is a man who had a traumatic divorce when he was a little boy. And he was asked, he had to go in front of a judge and say which parent he wanted to be with, and he refused to do it. And there was a lot of back and forth from one house to another, and it was very acrimonious. And so, you know, he's saying, I'm pulled away from something and pushed at the same time, and I can't decide which way to go. And then when the medicine started to work a little more fully, he started to say things like, I see my family all together. Why couldn't I have loved all of them and not felt bad? So that's the kind of thing that will happen when you're inside the medicine working. And then as he left the medicine, we might do some reflecting on what he said during that time. And so I might repeat to him something about it. I write all this down, very much like process notes.
Right.
So I might repeat to him, this is what you said. And he might say, this is exactly like it was in the divorce. Something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, someone, as you've described him, the glimpse you've given us, who comes to you so frozen in his mind and is able, through your work together, to be able to remember, recall, and redo in his mind the affective tightness and paralysis from his childhood scenario of being in front of a judge and being stuck, which parent, and ruminating like he presents to you ruminating, and replaces it with, instead of the rumination, maybe I could have loved them both. If we heard that in an analytic case conference, we would say, that's nice work. That's a nice outcome. We would wish that for a patient. And for a man like this, if that would be possible, it would be after many, many years of work. And what you're suggesting, tell me if I have this right, that you were able to help him own that, and I want to get the follow-up to the next day of the session, but at that moment, he was able to recognize that truth of his love as a boy, as opposed to the symptom of his paralysis now as a man.
The recognition is incredibly powerful, and I don't think I would have, it would have been very hard to get that kind of sadness, mm-hmm. wistfulness, and realization that he should have been allowed to have that as a child. I think only after, I mean, I don't know if I ever could have gotten there.
Right.
I don't think this is the end. In other words, you know.
What happened the next day and the next month?
So what's amazing, and he's had 4 ketamine sessions, and they have evolved, which is another interesting thing. They change and evolve and deepen very much parallel to the way an analysis does mm-hmm. on their own, independently of the work. But in the next month or so, there were, and he noticed it and talked to me about it, pretty remarkable but subtle changes. So, for example, he began having very intimate conversations with friends of his, other men. He felt much more open. I think he did not feel so guilty and constricted. He wrote a big no on a little note card and taped it to his computer monitor so that when people asked him to do things that he felt he needed to do to please them, he would be reminded that he could say no.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had much more of a settled sense about the trauma he came to me for, which was an affair. And he, I think, was starting to work on, you know, saying goodbye to that, why he did that. And I think what happened was he came to the divorce and how he had enacted something about the divorce. And so there was a lot of working through of those two things after the ketamine.
Now, again, ordinarily, one would expect this to play out in his imagined relationship with you, that you would be one of the parents, one of the mistresses, the disappointment one, the touching one. How did that, was that necessary for this work, or how did that play out?
So it's really interesting you asked that, because when I was looking through his notes in preparation for the podcast,
mm-hmm.
one of the things, he had to go pick the pills up before he came. And when he went to pick the pills up, the pharmacist said, oh no, your wife already came to get them. So actually, I had picked the pills up.
That's great.
And so he came in and said, apparently you're my wife.
So said the pharmacist. And now what does he say?
So I guess what I'm noticing is that was there.
Right.
Actually. And that was something that we really didn't talk about, but could come up in a treatment.
And that's what's really challenging. When I hear people say about how these medicines, you know, bypass the defenses or undo the defenses, I think to myself, gee, that's a misunderstanding. Defenses aren't our or the patient's enemies. The defenses have as much information in them as what they are defending against. And so we need to get to know them and unpack them so that the patient can get to know them and have more of a choice whether to be stuck by them or not. So the notion of bypassing defenses seems to me, when I hear it, naive. That said, I have met people who have had analyses and have had then subsequent psychedelic medicine treatments. And maybe the term isn't best, the defenses are eliminated, but there is a lightness to them, an aliveness to them, a less adhesive attachment to old stuck templates from childhood, that one could say that the defenses are softened, and that one doesn't necessarily have to unpack the defenses themselves, that they just sort of aren't as limiting. The compromise formations change, as we hope for in analysis, but not in the usual way.
I would say adhesive is the perfect way to describe the indication for ketamine. If the defenses feel adhesive and not loose, that is precisely what happens in a psychedelic treatment, that they become less adhesive, more useful in some ways to the patient. You know, defenses have resiliency in them. So, and they have ego strength in them too. And that's often what I talk to my patients about, is that these things have really helped you in the past. So we have to be curious about, you know, how they are useful to you even now. And the other thing I would say about ketamine treatment is it's an oscillation. It's not as if this just goes away, you know, his right. managers. It's,
sure.
It's a work in progress.
And you're continuing to see him in ongoing psychotherapy, right?
Yes, continuing to see him. He's had four right. ketamine sessions, and they've evolved, and he's doing great.
And how often do you see him without the ketamine?
Twice a week.
Right, and those are regular 45-minute sessions?
Those are 50-minute sessions.
Right, okay.
And then maybe every 2 months, we do a ketamine session.
I see. And in your experience, which prior to your use of ketamine has been extensive, doing traditional analysis and psychotherapy.
Absolutely.
You would say, this is sort of obvious, but let's put it on the table, that his progress is much quicker than you would have expected in non-ketamine adjunctive treatment.
I would say yes, but I'm the kind of person that always wonders, because I don't have a control experiment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if we had two lives, we could figure it out. But I would say this is moving him pretty quickly. And the other thing I would say is he feels it's moving him. And so I think we have to trust our patients when they tell us something is helping.
I so respect your caution about it, that there is a danger to jump on a bandwagon of saying, now we have found the answer to psychopathology.
And right.
we have been in this field long enough to realize that every few years there's a new magic bullet. And it was, whether it be discovery of trauma underlying everything, or, you know, Prozac is going to cure everything. And now,
right.
And we've all learned from experience that there isn't a magic pill, but there are good things that are happening that we can learn from, tipping our hats to Maimonides, who alerted us to the importance of this some time ago.
Yeah.
Where would you like to see the field, which field, both fields going either independent of each other or in relation to each other, the dynamic world and the psychedelic world?
So for the psychoanalytic world, I think I would love for the psychoanalytic world to re-embrace some of these adjunctive treatments that get to non-ordinary states of consciousness in order to enhance psychoanalytic treatment. And that includes psychedelics. The other thing about I'd like to see is I think psychoanalysts are extremely well suited to use psychedelic-assisted therapy in a non-harmful way. I really believe that without an ongoing treatment relationship, that these medicines are not going to be quick fixes. There's an article in the Substack blog, Ecstatic Integration, about a man, an Israeli man, who had an MDMA treatment for chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's a very interesting read, and it really does speak to the crucial aspect of having an ongoing therapy relationship while you're using these medicines. So I want people who are in the analytic field, who are trained right out of the box to provide these containers, to be more involved in the psychedelic field. And for the psychedelic field, I think sometimes I wish they would be a little more humble, a little less zealous about the efficacy and a little more concerned about what could happen that's harmful. And I also think the psychedelic field, for some reason, has not embraced, well, I think I know the reason, but not embraced psychoanalysis as a major tool to enhance, you know, the medicine.
Can you tell us something about the harm?
Let's see. So remember that these medicines, all of them, are nonspecific amplifiers, which means that when you're under the influence, anything that happens in the setting that feels good to you is going to be amplified in its goodness. Anything that happens in the setting that's bad or feels bad is going to be amplified in its badness. So it's going to stick as bad or stick as good. And so if you're in a scary setting, if someone does the wrong thing, if you're not appropriately supported after the experience, you can suffer traumatic symptoms. You can suffer, you know, hallucinogenic post-perceptual disorder. And there are, I think there's probably an increased risk of certain kinds of boundary violations. Whether it's more in the psychedelic field than it is, you know, in psychoanalysis or the field of psychiatry, which is, you know, in general is known for its boundary violations, I'm not sure. But I can see that the space is there. And, you know, I think I've seen some examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Charis, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your thoughtfulness about this. It's such a pleasure to speak to someone who's so sober about the use of medicines, if you don't mind the analogy. You're careful, you're thoughtful, you really are doing your best to live that Maimonides inspiration. And you certainly inspired me to think further about this, and I suspect many of our listeners as well. And there will be more to come. writing in this area. And I think we have an exciting future. As long as all of us share your caution and your experience and your deep experience, because you have made clear that it is really, you feel, on the basis of your extensive experience as a psychoanalyst and as a physician, both, that you bring, that enables you to provide a safe and inspiring frame for your patients to make the progress that you've shown that they can make.
Yeah.
So thank you for being with us today. Appreciate
it. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.